figured I'd have a prop. Hey, everybody. Good morning. How are y'all doing? The reason I do not have a name placard card is because I'm just doing an introduction, but the seat is actually pretty good. So I'm going to stay up here and make snide comments while Rob talks. Hopefully not too many. My name is Drew Curtis. I run a website called FARC out of Kentucky. And Rob asked me if I would introduce him because the way that I reacted to his conversation we had when he was explaining what he was getting into this year. Rob and I know each other from TED. I've known his wife a lot longer. And we were hanging out at a bar or something last year. And he says, oh, I've got this great idea for a book. And he goes and he tells me the entire idea for the book. And I'm like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. Are you kidding me? Then I get the manuscript, though, and it turns out it's actually really awesome. Amazingly awesome. I'm kind of surprised that anybody can make a career pivot from founding Rhapsody to being an awesome science fiction author, but Rob's actually done it. And then he went one further and he parlayed it into a TED Talk this year. And you're going to see a little bit of what he gave up on the main stage for that, and a little bit of a longer explanation of why the music industry is so messed up in the head, as we say in Kentucky. So without further ado, Rob Reed, folks.
Thank you, Drew. So thank you, everybody, for coming out at this kind of ghastly hour on a Saturday morning. And as Drew said, before I get into the presentation, I want to start with a very, very quick overview of a quasi-scientific realm that I call copyright math. It'll be germane to the first half of my presentation, and who doesn't like a little bit of math on a Saturday morning? No need to answer that. As the name suggests, copyright math is simply a dispassionate analysis of copyright issues through a quantitative framework. And with all the emotion that's surrounding the debates over SOPA in the U.S. and the ACTA agreement in Europe, I think a little dispassionate quantitative analysis can be really helpful. So to give you one example of copyright math in action, the Motion Picture Association recently revealed that our economy loses $58 billion a year to content theft. Now, rather than just argue about this number, a good copyright mathematician is going to analyze it, and he'll be able to determine quite quickly that this is enough money to spread from this or stretch from this convention center clear across 6th Street to the state capitol and then to Mars. If we use pennies, which is obviously a very powerful insight. And it's also a morally important one if you listen to the copyright industry, because what they'll tell you is this isn't just the hypothetical retail value of some pirated movies we're talking about, but actual economic losses. This would be analogous to the entire American corn crop failing, along with all of our fruit crops, as well as wheat, cotton, tobacco, rice, and even something called sorghum. But identifying the economy's actual losses to content theft is almost impossible without using this wonderful tool called copyright math. American music sales are down by about $8 billion since Napster first came onto the scene, so that's a chunk of it. But total movie revenues across theaters, home video, and pay-per-view are up. And TV, satellite, and cable revenues are way up, and other markets like radio and publishing, book publishing, are also up. So this last missing chunk is a little bit puzzling. Since the big content markets have grown in line with historic norms, it can't be additional growth that piracy somehow forestalled. So it's got to be foregone growth from a market that has no historic norms, one that didn't exist in the 90s. In other words, the copyright math tells us that we're looking here at the cost of ringtone piracy. $50 billion of it every year. And another great trick of copyright math, I can tell you that is enough ringtones at 30 seconds each to stretch from here to Neanderthal times. Another powerful insight. The movie folks also say that content piracy has killed over 370,000 jobs, which is quite a bit when you consider that back in 98, the Bureau of Labor Statistics put the motion picture and video industries at 270,000 total jobs. We had another 45,000 in music. So we've been left with negative content employment as a result of all the piracy and so forth. And this is just one of the many mind-bending realities that copyright mathematicians deal with daily, kind of like string theory in a way. This is a key number that I'm going to come back to from the copyright mathematician's toolkit. It is the amount of harm that media companies suffer whenever someone pirates a single copy of a song. Now, we know this number precisely because Hollywood and Congress derived it mathematically back when they last improved copyright laws. And yes, the name of the law was the Copyright Damages Improvement Act of 1999. Now, some people think this number seems a little bit large, but copyright mathematicians who are media lobby experts are merely surprised that it's not adjusted for inflation every year. I mean, it's been 13 years. When this law was passed, the world's hottest MP3 player could hold just 10 songs. Who doesn't remember the Diamond Rio? And it was a major Christmas hit, by the way, because what little hoodlum wouldn't want $1.5 million worth of stolen goods in his back pocket for Christmas? These days, an iPod Classic can hold 40,000 songs, which is to say $8 billion worth of stolen media, or about 75,000 jobs. So thank you for bearing with my quick little introduction to copyright math. I went through it because it illuminates the difference in the perspective that the music and publishing industries have had toward their respective digital transitions, particularly early on, slightly less today, arguably. The music industry looked at things through this peculiar lens of copyright math, a lens through which any fact can be proven, any lawsuit can be argued, any legislative perversion can be justified. And the important point that I'm going to make here is it really didn't help their interests at all. In fact, it damaged them terribly in ways that I don't think that they appreciated it at the time. So this brings me to the main body of my presentation. So thanks again for coming. I thought I'd start by decoding my presentation's strange title. First Rhapsody. Back in 1999, I founded a company called Listen.com in San Francisco. We launched a bunch of different services, culminating with the Rhapsody Music Service about 3 years later. I'll be talking quite a bit more about Rhapsody in a moment. It's still going strong and so forth. The other net part of the title, Year Zero, I have, as you mentioned, gone through a radical career change, and Year Zero is the title of my debut science fiction novel, which Random House's Del Rey imprint is going to be publishing in July. And now, given that the cover combines aspects of the Napster logo, the Listen.com logo, and the classic alien Roswell head, you might get the idea it's about something demented and insane like aliens pirating music. You would be entirely correct. That's my little summary right there. Aliens seek to erase the ruinous finds on their vast collections of pirated American music by destroying the Earth. A young attorney must use his wits to stop them. And by the way, that's the last I'm going to say about Year Zero, because I'm not here to talk about my book per se. I'm here to talk about things that I've learned about the rise of digital publishing by dint of being a very tech-minded and also startup-minded author with a major publisher, combined with things that I learned about music during the Rhapsody days. But before I drop the subject of Year Zero, the book entirely, if anybody is in the business of reviewing books, particularly intellectual property science fiction comedies, I'd be happy to get you a review copy. It won't be this one, because this is the only one that I have, but Random House has many others just like it in New York, and they also have electronic galleys. So if anybody's interested in that, come up to me afterward, give me your card, tell me who you're with, whether you're a reviewer or a journalist who just is interested in the topic. I'd be happy to get you set up with it. Anyway, so not talking about Year Zero of the book, I am going to be talking about these digital transitions of these industries that I know very well through personal experience. Now, the first thing when you lay music and publishing down next to each other and you compare these digital transitions, there are some really striking differences, and that's the first thing that you notice and the first thing I'm going to talk about. But there's also some remarkable and surprising and subtle similarities, and perhaps even one very deep irony, all of which we'll explore now. First, though, a very, very brief history, the early background of Rhapsody, for those of you who are not entirely expert in its history, which I assume is pretty much all of you. Rhapsody is significant because we were the first online music service to sign full catalog deals with all five of the major labels. Of course, there are now three major labels and the number is dropping rapidly, but back then there were five. We were a strictly unlimited streaming service, music service, when we launched. And although we added downloads later, Rhapsody still remains primarily a streaming service to this day. We got our fifth and final major label deal done with Universal, naturally, in July of 2002. And it was almost a year before Apple got all five of their deals done. So we actually got to be number one in the market for about 9 months. Now, naturally, about a nanosecond after Apple launched the iTunes service, we went immediately to number two. And we actually hung on to that slot for many years. And it was a long time at number two. But much as I'd like to think it was this sort of thing, it was really a lot more like this. We were a very distant number two in RC in a world with no Pepsi. We were the Carl's Jr. to their McDonald's, the Cessna to their Boeing, the O-Town to their Backstreet Boys. Pick your analogy. We were a remarkably distant number two. But we were the first to get the deals done with all the five major labels, and that should count for something a little bit. I don't know. I like to think it does. But although we were first to market with the majors, the music's digital age got started way before Rhapsody. I'd say in 1999, because that was the year, the first full year, that the Diamond Multimedia Rio, which I alluded to earlier, shipped in serious volumes. That was the first mass market MP3 player, selling hundreds of thousands of units rather than just token volumes. And it was the last core piece of infrastructure that really needed to fall into place in order for music to truly go digital. By then, the internet was fast enough to move music files around, at least in white-collar offices and in universities. Disk spaces were big enough to hold interesting music collections, but we couldn't get things portable. And finally, with the Diamond Multimedia Rio, we could listen to music portably. So I think the starting gun, year zero, for digital music is 99. It came a lot later for books. And the reason is the Kindle didn't burst onto the scene until 2007. So that's year zero for me on the publishing side. Now, by then, interestingly, bandwidth and certainly disk space had been plenty adequate for text files for many years. But the lethal constraint had been the price performance of LCD screens. And pretty much the instant that LCDs became ready to do Kindle-like things, Amazon jumped on and the publishing world will never be the same. So what happened to these two industries after their respective years zero, which is probably grammatically correct? The music industry's experience is, of course, very famous. Catastrophic implosion. And by the way, these are domestic sales. And I'll actually talk about my data sources in a moment. They're very good on the music front. To compare this to what's happening in publishing, I'm going to zero in on the first 5 years of data that we have from music and compare them to the 5 years that we have so far on publishing so we can compare how these respective things got started. And then to normalize it a little bit more to make it a bit more apples to apples, I'm going to take each of these five-year periods and normalize it into percentage terms. So for music, 1999's total sales, which was about $14.5 billion in the U.S., I'm calling it 100%, and then we see how things tail off after that. So how does that compare to publishing's first five digital years? Well, publishing's done fine. There's a bit of a drop-off with the start of the recession, and then things bounced along pretty nicely. I mean, they go up and down a little bit, but it kind of looks like noise in the data for the most part. And this is during a very, very rapid transition to digital sales, which is usually very dislocating. Yes, sir? Good question. The question is units or dollar volumes? This is dollar sales that I have here, and this actually is a good transition to a brief word on sources. The data sources, these are domestic numbers. It's dollar volumes. Surprisingly, the unit volumes don't shift it that much, but it gets messy because then you've got singles and albums and, you know, trade, mass market. So this is dollar volumes. The book sales that we're looking at here are consumer book sales. I'm not looking at professional and academic. Those are kind of different markets, and they're less analogous to the consumer music market. The other thing is my data source on the music side is almost 100% the Recording Industry Association of America. You can say what you want about that organization. I have said a lot, but their data tools are awesome for researchers. They've got great, great data. Books is a lot harder because there is not a centralized data repository. I ended up pulling together data from the American Booksellers Association, public statements by different publicly traded companies, bit of this from Nielsen, bit of that from Forrester. The good news is that the book data actually did end up triangulating very nicely. So I actually feel very good about both sets of data, but the book data is a little bit kind of messier. So what in the world is going on here? Why do we have such a big difference? And I think the answer lies in the very different reactions that the two industries had to the rise of digital. And we're going to start by looking at music. And this is going to be a bit more of a familiar story, I think. The Rio first shipped in September of 1998. And we launched Rhapsody about 3 years after that. But it took us 9 months to get our major label deals on board. Before that, we were basically this odd little trove for aficionados of Eastern European symphonies, particularly those from Romania. But what I'd like to think of our major label deals that we finally signed in July of 2002 as being some kind of historic watershed, the truth is the world really didn't care. Because at that point, the world was obsessively focused, and to a great degree still is, on downloads, because that was how you got portability in those primitive times before 4G. And of course, the market does still skew that way, although it's starting to change a little bit. So Apple came to market with the very download-friendly iPod in late 2001, which was a much bigger development than anything we ever did at Rhapsody. But then the labels took a year and a half to very grudgingly let Apple sell downloads. And so the labels literally forced their customers to wait for almost 5 years to get what they, the customers, desperately wanted, and what the technology was perfectly capable of providing, which was this exotic thing called a portable music download. Not such a strange thing, but it was a five-year period of time. I call it the embargo. And it had lethal consequences, as we'll see, this five-year embargo. Now, the labels certainly weren't inactive during this five-year embargo. In fact, it took them less than a single month to salute the Rio's historic debut with a lawsuit, which luckily failed. The labels basically wanted to make open MP3 players completely illegal in this country. So assault weapons, yes. iPods, no. Then along came Napster. The labels sued them quickly, and that didn't surprise anybody. But then a much bigger surprise came when a company, a very legitimate company that had absolutely nothing to do with piracy, called MP3.com, tried to launch a digital locker service. And you can think of this as being a very, very bandwidth-friendly, very smart, frankly, forerunner to the digital locker services that Google and Amazon and everybody else is offering today. The RIAA didn't wait even 10 days to sue them. And this sent a very chilling signal to all of us who were doing entrepreneurship in the music domain. It basically said that any product, however benign, well-intentioned, and absolutely copyright-friendly, was all too liable to get sued in the music market. And this was incredibly toxic. And the labels are still, in my view, reaping the consequences of this and other similar decisions to this day. But people didn't stop trying to come up with ideas entirely. A flash-in-the-pan company called Aimster, which came up with a way of using AOL's Instant Messenger, or AIM, to distribute MP3s, came onto the scene with predictable results. Then a month later, we had another very toxic case of the labels suing entirely legitimate companies when they came after a company called Music Match and three others as well. There were four defendants. Over launching interactive radio services that were essentially forerunners to today's Pandora service. Now, to give you a sense of just how utterly debased and crooked these Music Match people were, once everything was settled, they ended up selling their business to that bastion of internet piracy called Yahoo for $160 million. It's also interesting to note that MP3.com, once they were thoroughly exhausted by lawsuits, sold at a fire sale price to that other bastion of internet piracy called Universal Music. So we can question how really awful these guys were in their copyright stuff. Countless other suits, Kazaa, which I'm sure you all remember, Audio Galaxy, which was based down here in Austin, and so many more. Now, clearly, many of the companies that were sued during this period were engaging in practices that most people would consider to be piracy. But while a lot of companies got shut down, piracy did not go away at all. Just a few months after Napster shut, its successors were collectively enabling more downloads than ever before. Only now, there were dozens of these services rather than just one that you could theoretically do business with. So however expensive, high profile, and even emotionally cathartic the piracy lawsuits were, they didn't actually have any meaningful business impact. They didn't benefit the labels financially, and they didn't have any impact on the effect the piracy was having on the market. What did affect the market, and this is really important, and affect it immensely, and affect it to this very day, was the labels' efforts to basically thwart the emergence of almost every core element of today's digital music experience. We do not want MP3 players. We do not want interactive radio. We do not want locker services. We are not going to license our music, et cetera, et cetera. In doing this, they basically declared war on the entrepreneurs and investors who had shown up in hopes of building some really great, innovative, copyright-friendly services. All that entrepreneurial energy could have been and should have been the superpower that the music industry had to beat back the wave of piracy by putting up services that were simply better than piracy. Instead, all of that energy dissipated when people realized how hostile the environment was. And then meanwhile, the labels continued to flatly refuse to sell their music in the digital formats that by now hundreds of millions of their customers were clamoring for. And this had a huge impact because there's this iron law of physics. I'm not sure who came up with it. I've seen it attributed to everybody from Aristotle to Spinoza to Thoreau, literally. But whoever it was, as we all know, nature abhors a vacuum. And I'll tell you, media abhors a vacuum as well. If we go from a world without radio in the turn of the century to radio ubiquity in the 1940s, the sky is going to fill with radio broadcasts. And if we go from channel capacity, TV channel capacity of 10 channels to 100 channel capacity, pretty soon you're simply going to have 100 channels. It's just the way it goes. Media pours a vacuum. And if a hard drive expands by a factor of 600, one way or another, it's going to fill up. And that's exactly what happened to the capacity of MP3 players during this 5-year embargo. So by the time the iTunes Store finally launched and the labels were ready to give people that which they wanted, countless people had had room for thousands and thousands of songs in their hip pockets for many years. And that amounted to quite a vacuum. And with the labels refusing to fill that vacuum with sanctioned downloads, piracy was there to do the job. No number of lawsuits could or did stop that. So for hundreds of millions of music fans now, what does this embargo amount to? And I think it basically amounted to a training period. People got really, really good at pirating music because that was the only way to get this stuff that they wanted. First with Napster, which was really easy to use, and then with all the finicky and more complicated services that followed. Now, during this time, my company and many others went to the labels frequently, basically imploring them to allow us to launch services into this void. And this is what we constantly heard. Competing with free is impossible. It was a mantra. We're going to sue these pirating services out of existence, and then maybe we'll talk to you about licenses. And you'd be having this conversation in a label executive's office, and they would look at you and ask rhetorically, but very sincerely and with great concern. I mean, these people were wrestling with a very devastating situation. And they'd say, seriously, why would anybody ever pay anything for something they could get for free? And you'd be sitting there drinking this $9 Armani water, and which is part of an industry that's done pretty well competing with free. And eventually, however, the labels did give their customers what they wanted after 5 years, which for a very eclectic few was my funny service of Rhapsody, but for most was a functional download store. And so the commercial services did finally start competing with free. We were finally permitted to do it. And it turns out this can be done quite successfully, as we'll see, particularly in the case of publishing. But it is very hard, and it's much, much harder if your main supplier has basically spent the last half decade training your customers in the arts of obtaining their product for nothing. Since the end of the embargo, the music industry has not exactly stopped suing. They started by suing over 30,000 Americans over a 5-year period for uploading illegal music. Their bludgeon was this abomination of a law called the Copyright Damages Improvement Act of 1999 that I alluded to earlier, which calls for penalties of up to $150,000 per song uploaded or downloaded if it's pirated music. As a practical matter, they've only been suing uploaders. In the middle of this, the RIAA sued XM for releasing a product that connected an XM receiver to a hard drive that could then be used to record radio shows. Now, from the dawn of time, it had actually been technically impossible to record a radio show until XM went and did this. So I guess that's why they sued them. That was sarcasm. Then the media companies sued Real Networks, the publicly traded law-abiding company that I sold Rhapsody to, because Real Networks was making software that could enable somebody to record a DVD to their hard drive. Now, this is something that millions and millions of copies of shareware software do every day throughout this planet. Now, as a result of all this, music remains an entirely radioactive domain to most of the tech community. I know countless entrepreneurs and investors who are wildly, madly about, passionate about music and would love nothing more than to be part of the field, but they completely shun it because of all the insanity, the lawsuits, the withheld licenses, et cetera, et cetera. And the consequences of this are a near total lack of innovation in this domain, which is really sad. When iTunes finally launched, there were three basic modes of consuming music online. There were a la carte downloads, unlimited streaming services like Rhapsody, and interactive radio services like Launch.com. And now, almost 10 years later, we have a la carte downloads like iTunes, unlimited streaming services like Rhapsody and Spotify, and interactive radio like Pandora. What's missing? I frankly don't know. But I do know that it's a lot. And I know it's a lot because I know my peers from the first generation of online music. We weren't dumb, but we weren't geniuses. And we didn't think up everything that could possibly be done with music online in the first 20 months of our industry's history. We just weren't that smart. And meanwhile, the A-team has been out for the last 10 years building social networks, mobile applications, ambient location transmitters, Highlight, Glancy, anybody using that? It's been really fun. And a ton of other things. Now, there's still some talented people who are working in music, but it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the talent, the vision, and the capital that music should be drawing in its ongoing battle with piracy, and it's absent. And as a result, the user experience in online music, it's moved forward, but it has not moved forward anywhere near as much as it should have or would have. And that's kind of sad. Now, before I move on to talk about publishing, there's one really, really important point that I want to make, and that is that the time that separated the appearance of the RIO from the moment when more music was being transferred over the internet than was being transferred by CDs was literally 2 years. And in the history of capitalism, there has never been more sudden, more dislocating, more unprecedented change of that violence in a generations-old industry. Yes, we have transitions like that in technology, but that's usually in markets that are like 3 years old. This was an industry that had been around for generations, and this would not have been an easy transition for anybody to handle. I mean, compare that to, say, trains and planes. You know, the oldest commercial airline, KLM, first flew in 1919. It was over 40 years before airplanes were distributing more passenger miles than trains. And everybody knew that radio was doomed the moment that NBC started commercial telecasts, but it was over 20 years before there were more American households with TVs in them than there were radio-only households. And from the time that the first cable box was installed, it was about 50 years before cable viewership exceeded broadcast viewership. My point is, these are decadal changes, and the music industry faced them. Face changes that were every bit as thorough and dislocating, compressed into 2 years. And so while it's really, really easy for someone like me to critique their actions, even history's greatest business people probably would have blown this one. It was too fast. It was too dislocating. It was too unprecedented. I mean, could you imagine Henry Ford dealing with digital pirated cars or something? Rockefeller dealing with peer-to-peer oil? They would have blown it. And so while it's reasonable to be critical of the label's actions, I believe very strongly that it isn't fair to say that they blew this because they were evil and stupid. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying that they were not evil and stupid. They might have been, but the fact that they blew this transition doesn't prove that. It merely proves that they were human. The other point is, for those of you who are dealing with the major labels right now, it's important to remember that most of the truly disastrous decisions were made 10 to 15 years ago. A lot of the people who made them are long gone. And in my experience, and I do keep up with the industry, there are lots of people who really, really get it in all of the major labels today. In fact, a lot of them are refugees from early online music services like my own and even some that are later than that. So important caveat there. But on to a happier topic, which is the first half decade of mass market digital publishing. The most important difference here, as you'll probably expect me to say, is how the major publishers greeted the rise of digital. Now, FYI, for people who are not in publishing, there are six major publishers worldwide. They're all quite significant here in the United States as well. Collectively, they have maybe 50% market share. I've seen numbers higher and lower, but ballpark it to that. But unlike their counterparts in music, they didn't wait 5 years to get on board with the Kindle. In fact, they didn't even wait 5 minutes. When the Kindle launched, the major publishers were all there in force, and not in a token way, but with their very best-selling frontline content. About 90% of the New York Times bestsellers were available on the Kindle from day one. And this made the Kindle into a power tool for selling the label's product from the get-go. Compare that to the millions and millions of early MP3 players that sold and never vended a single song. And this is why we have these two very different outcomes. The labels tried to fight the internet off. The publishers co-opted it from day one, admittedly with having had the benefit of watching the labels' mistakes. And we can see this vividly by breaking these numbers down a little bit further. Here, the red segments are digital sales, and the blue segments are physical sales. And as you see, the erosion in physical sales between music and publishing is really not all that different. The only difference is that the publishers filled the gap by actually deigning to sell digital products, whereas the labels embargoed it. Now, the publishers gained a lot from this. First and most obviously, the rather awesome $2 billion in annualized sales that they racked up last year, digital sales, that they didn't have 5 years ago and for which the labels obviously had nothing. But there were other big benefits as well. Perhaps the biggest one is in the realm of piracy. As we saw earlier, just 2 years after the Rio shipped, more songs were being downloaded over the internet than were being distributed by CD. And because of the embargo, those songs were not being sold. Whereas 5 years into this thing with publishing, digital piracy has yet to have a major impact on sales. Now, it does happen. People are very aware of it. They're concerned about it. It's a long-term threat. But of the dozens of conversations that I've had, with people in the industry since I started kind of becoming a part of it as an author, it hasn't actually emerged as a top five concern for anyone. I always ask them, what are the five big issues? Whereas music, 90% of the industry's digital mind share was maniacally focused on piracy during those first 5 years. Yes, sir. Yeah, so DRM, let me get to that at the end in the Q&A, because that's actually a very fascinating and complex topic. The question is, has DRM been responsible for this? And I don't think so, because when the labels finally started selling music, it was even more DRM'd than digital publishing files are now. And I think that digital publishing files will eventually move away from DRM, probably in a similar time frame to the labels, but we'll get back to that. So why hasn't piracy had the same impact on publishing? I think the main reason actually is not DRM, but it's because the world first learned about how awesome e-books are from this immaculately balanced and integrated thing that landed in our hands, which pulled together wonderful technology, wonderful content, wonderful retail presentation, a really, really smart distribution mechanism with the WhisperNet, and it delivered something that piracy simply couldn't match. And all this with a huge range of content and titles, and all of this at very fair prices. And so when piracy sort of showed up, not long at all after the Kindle shipped, with a much crappier experience that was a giant step backward, the world just wasn't electrified. And compare that to music. The world learned that downloadable music was awesome and that we wanted it really badly, and it wasn't available to us for 5 years. So when genuinely crappy pirate services, really crappy compared to like today's Spotify or today's iTunes, came along, they seemed awesome to everybody. And they were awesome compared to schlepping it to a store to buy 15 songs that had been glued together on a disc, and what you really wanted was one particular song at this instant. So the publishers got out there with a product that was way better than piracy, and that's how we learned about ebooks, and that I think is critical. Now, another big win for the publishers from embracing technology rather than driving it off has been in hardware diversity. 5 years in, digital music had only one portable player of genuine consequence, and that was the iPod. All of the entrepreneurial energy and capital that might have given Apple a run for its money was simply driven off by the lawsuits and all the other insanity. And so the labels successfully, and this wasn't easy because there was a lot of excitement around hardware innovation early on, but the labels managed to dissipate that and create an incredibly dangerous dependency on Apple for themselves. And not just for hardware, but for download sales as well, and perhaps someday for streaming services. And the labels now rail about this constantly, about how terrible it is that Apple is all-powerful. And they are right to be concerned, but that's what happens when you scare away 95% of your potential partners. Publishing has a lot of platforms, so many that it's messy. You have the software for one platform running on the hardware of another. In fact, the platform situation in publishing right now is so complicated that the Department of Justice is butting its head into the market because it can't understand it. And I think they're about to do some unbelievably stupid things. That's a long story. Believe me, the publishers, despite this, are very, very worried about Amazon's power, but they would be a lot more worried about Amazon if they had driven away everybody but Amazon in the manner that the labels did. So there are a lot of benefits for publishing from co-opting and embracing the technology. Now, where do things go from here for publishing? A lot of it depends on where the digital transition stops. Do books go away entirely? Do we stabilize at 50% books? There actually seems to be some gravitational tug around this 50% number, because I've seen it forecasted by at least a few people. Here's one of them, the head of digital at Hachette, which is one of the big six publishers. She says, there is a natural limit to the growth of digital. I think it might be 50%. Once we reach a plateau, we're going to have two businesses, a digital business and a physical business. Why is that? She says, the book is an object, is a perfect object. It has a lot of utility. People love it. There's something special about a book. Now, this is no shill for the pulp and paper industry. She runs digital for a big six publisher, and she is entirely correct about this special love for books. People never had that for CDs. It was a lot easier to love a vinyl album, which was a much more tactile and enveloping container. But even with vinyl, once you drop that needle, you are interacting with the music in a way that is very similar to our interaction with a digital file today, in that you were listening to it. Unless you were completely baked, you didn't continue to fondle the packaging for the next half hour. Not so with books. Reading has always meant a continuous tactile engagement with a unique and beautifully designed object, or at least carefully designed object. And unlike CDs, books make wonderful furniture. And highly visual books and children's books have big physical advantages. And so she's right about all this. That said, I think this 50% number is unbelievably optimistic for lovers of physical books, because there are forces that are even more powerful than consumer loyalties and preferences. And surprise, surprise, some data from the music industry will show us. I can change my slide. Here we go. As we saw before, this is what happened to American music sales. And ugly as this picture is, it's even worse if you're a physical music store, because for you, there's really no difference between a sale that's gone digital and a sale that's been lost to piracy. So this, kind of to state the obvious, is the way that sales have looked to physical music stores, dropping and accelerating rather than dropping and finally stabilizing, which has happened to the industry as a whole. Now, let's take a look at this acceleration close up. This is the year-to-year percentage drop in physical music sales. It clearly, right after 2006, and maybe even midway into 2006, things got really ugly. So what went on in that terrible year? Well, it was the year that the retail music died. Three giant chains all shut down. And as fewer and fewer people had a convenient record store to go to, even technophobes who were very, very loyal to CDs were at some point forced to experiment with digital. Most of them found that they really liked it, and that put things into free fall. So when was the tipping point? Well, to answer that, I'm going to take one final look at the data, this time going back to my little technique of using 1999 as 100%. This is physical sales in the United States. 1999, $14.5 billion of physical CDs sold. That's 100%. We see how it tails off. This deadly year of 2006, the market had only dropped about 30% from its all-time peak. In other words, a very big majority of sales were still, physical sales were still happening, of peak physical sales were still happening. But not many merchants can survive a sudden and unexpected 30% drop in their top line. So the merchants started to vanish, which pushed more people into digital, which caused more merchants to vanish, et cetera, et cetera. Classic death spiral. And where are we now with books? Well, while the industry as a whole is much healthier because, as I've told you before, physical sales are being replaced with digital sales instead of piracy, that's cold comfort if you're a book retailer. If you're a book retailer in 2012, the world looks like this, which is to say physical sales are down by coming up on 30% this year. It's roughly as bad as it was for the music industry in 2006, and there is certainly a very, very close parallel to Tower Records failing and the fact that we lost Borders last year. And if anything, this chart actually understates the contraction in shelf space for books because many merchants, most notably Barnes & Noble, are stocking more and more non-book items to hedge their bets. So every day, more and more people are failing to find a certain book. They're giving digital a test drive. They're finding they're liking it. We're seeing the same kind of vicious cycle here. Does that mean books are going to follow the music pattern here clear into the ground? In my opinion, no. I do think that physical publishing will absolutely stabilize with more, significantly more market share than the end point for physical music, which, by the way, I think is going to be very close to zero apart from vinyl. So music will always be much further down this path than publishing. But publishing's way out in front on another path, one that I think presents far more danger for publishers than it does for the music labels. And you can see this yourself by looking at a certain digital bestseller chart. This is a snapshot of the 100 best-selling items on the Kindle on Thursday. 16 were apps or magazines. Of the actual books, 45% were self-published. Now, this just doesn't happen in music. If a band scores a huge hit entirely independently on its own, it is such big news, it is downright exotic. And when the band does that, it's almost invariably a band that had a significant following beforehand, like Radiohead. And let me prove that to you by showing you what I consider to be the most shocking statistic of any in the digital world. And coming from a data nerd like me, that's a big statement. It's kind of like Ted Nugent saying, and let me show you my best gun. This is the market share that the major labels collectively had in 1999. Since then, they have suffered all of the disasters that we've talked about. Since then, the disintermediating internet has enabled massive connections between their fans and their artists, both of whom kind of hate the labels, by the way. Their physical channel is virtually gone. Their digital channel is dominated by Apple, and the impact on the major labels' dominance has been nothing short of astonishing. There it is. This is from an incredibly thorough study that Billboard and Nielsen just finished. The major labels dominate music sales more than they ever have before. You don't have dozens of unsigned artists storming up the charts. In fact, you don't have any, because that scrawny 12% market share that is not controlled by the major labels is not controlled by unsigned artists. It's controlled by independent labels, some of which, like Merge Records down in North Carolina, are pretty darn big, sophisticated operations. So why can authors make this utterly independent run for it when musicians generally can't? And I truly wish I had a full hour to discuss this, because it's a fascinating topic. I'm going to very briefly breeze through the four biggest reasons as I see them. Reason number one, first and foremost, radio. Despite all the downloads in our cars and in our iPods and in our cell phones, radio remains the market-shaping music discovery channel, bar none. Also, the playlists in commercial radio have gotten so short and so homogenized that getting a song onto them is a blisteringly competitive process. It simply cannot be taken on without a label, period. The majors dominate commercial radio. The indies do much better with college. They're both in there with satellite. There is no comparable force to radio and publishing. Second, tourists. Not all musicians do it, but those who are in the process of developing an audience, particularly a mass audience, almost have to. Don't quite have to, but they almost have to. Labels leave a lot of the heavy lifting to managers and others, but they definitely help with tour support, with connections to key festivals, and a whole lot more. Compare this to literature. Although some authors do bookstores, most do not. And it's nowhere near it as integral to success in literature as it is to touring in music. In fact, it's entirely optional. Third, production cost and complexity. You could write the most intricate novel in history on a $600 laptop. Now, great music can also be made on a laptop, and in fact is made on laptops, but greater music can almost invariably be made with great producers, sound engineers, and session musicians working in specialized facilities with specialized equipment. Although, like everything that uses digital ingredients, great audio production is getting cheaper. But ambitious music projects will always be far more expensive than any traditional book project. They need to be funded. And for the most part, in commercial music, the label is playing the role of the venture capitalist. And there's no getting around that for most. Some bands do it on their own, most can't. Finally, contracts. The labels lock them in, usually a 5-album deal. So if a huge hit turns a band into a franchise, the label doesn't have to worry about them, you know, going off to iTunes and selling their second album to their fans directly. And by the way, there are things like this in publishing, but it's far, 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 far less common. And by the way, very few bands actually get past that fifth album without getting dropped by their label, particularly now. So the overall market is dominated by newcomers who absolutely need labels to get radio and financing, plus a few mature bands whose most commercial and influential work is usually on their earliest, most label-controlled music. Because after 5 albums, it's usually been a decade, and the new generation doesn't always want to listen to the cool English teacher's music. So that's why you still have this huge skewing toward the majors. So going back to this very un-music-like phenomenon, should publishers care that half of the top-selling digital titles in Kindle, and by the way, this is true in Barnes & Noble as well, are self-published? My answer is maybe not if it's 2009, but it isn't. Physical book sales are plunging, and the e-books market, which is empirically more friendly to wholly self-produced content than any significant media market in history, will soon be dominant, and perhaps, I'd say probably overwhelmingly so. Now, there's a mitigating subtlety that I need to admit here, which is that this chart doesn't represent market share. For now, there are far more mid-selling published titles than mid-selling self-published titles. And the middle market is very, very important in publishing. The other important point is that this certainly doesn't represent, this is like title share. It doesn't represent dollar market share, to get back to that earlier question. And the reason is that self-published digital books tend to be a lot cheaper than published ones. Published ebooks typically range from about $7 to $15, whereas the most common price for self-published books is $2.99, Why? Because this is the lowest price that you can charge and still get Amazon's maximum revenue split of 70%. That's a very nice revenue split and cheap sells. Ergo, the self-published authors tend to congregate around that $2.99 number, although some of them go way below, as low as 99 cents. $2.99 is kind of like the plurality. So these self-published people are grossing a fraction of what a published author can draw. But do they care? Do they lose sleep over that or feel inferior? To answer that, let's compare a published author who's selling at $9.99, which is a very common price for published, and a self-published author who's at that magic price of $2.99. First off, Amazon takes the same 30% from both of them. Then comes the publisher. The standard deal in ebooks right now is a quarter to the author, three quarters to the publisher. Only this person over here, the self-published person, obviously by definition doesn't have a publisher. So the self-published author is already ahead, just two steps into the game. The published author probably has an agent, and the standard rate there is 15% of what is going to the author, which is another savings for the self-published person who's now making about 50% more per copy, despite selling at a 70% discount. In fact, the published author doesn't catch up with $3 Chuck unless the price goes up about above $14 for the published book. Is this common? Well, of all of the 100 titles on Kindle's Hot 100 last night, only three books were selling for more than $14. So the self-published authors are almost certainly making more money per copy. And in many cases, they're selling more copies. Consider Lauren Wittig, who's self-published The Charming of the Shrew, is 12 slots above James Patterson's latest book just a few weeks after both premiered. But does Hachette care? They probably never wanted to publish Charming the Shrew in the first place. I think they may care if established authors start paying attention to this. Ones who aren't famous strictly for being self-published phenoms, but who have the sort of name identification and established readerships that do inspire people to pay $7 to $15 for a book. Now, what scenario might this type of author be looking at if they are thinking about defecting from their publisher? I assume they'd price somewhere between the other two. An established self-published author should clearly outprice an unknown self-published author. So they'll be north of $2.99, but they'll probably price below where they used to be with a publisher because they're going to have less media buzz, access to reviewers, and so forth. The math flows through like this. So here we have a known author with a readership who goes independent and makes almost four times as much money per copy. This author would almost certainly sell more books if they stayed with their publisher. But we're not, but would he sell four times as many? The answer is almost certainly if it was an overwhelmingly physical world. In an overwhelmingly digital world, maybe not. An unknown author would certainly sell a lot more with a publisher, but we're not talking about unknown authors now. And if the established author, hang on a second, yes, if the established author was lucky enough to be one of those very rare authors who gets enormous budgets put behind them by their publisher, they'll want to stay put, but that's not many authors. Somebody who's sort of plodding along within a particular genre or a series is going to be very, very tempted by this model. So I think this is where the publishers face risk. They've done a masterful job of co-opting technology, which the labels failed at. As a result, they've done very well against piracy so far, but they risk defection in the creative ranks that the labels are largely immune from. But I don't think it's all doom and gloom. First, I'll admit I'm biased because I have a fabulous relationship with my publisher, but this is a common thing for authors to say, which is significant in and of itself. You won't hear many musicians saying that about their labels, and loyalty does count for a lot. Secondly, publishers do a lot for their big cut of sales. They finance books. They're venture capitalists as well. They pay the advances that authors live off of while they're writing, and they fund the development costs of the book. Now, those are admittedly pretty tiny compared to what we often see in music and very small compared to what we see in movies. Developmental editing is most important. This is when a good editor teams up with an author to really shape the story and the book. It's kind of like a coach with an athlete. Then there are lots of other logistical steps, copy editing, which is grammar and usage, cover design, etc. Then there's the physical channel. This is something that only a publisher can get an author through. It just requires scale and expense that only organizations have.
And then finally, awareness of the author's works, which we'll discuss in a moment because it's the most important subject. The important thing is that as recently as the 90s, all of these functions required a publisher, even something as simple and seemingly contractor-friendly as copy editing. Unless you were in the publishing industry, how would you ever find a bunch of freelance copy editors, investigate their reputations, collect competitive bids, and hire one? You couldn't do it. But these days, things have changed thanks to online reputation-based freelance markets. You can buy anything in this development quadrant a la carte. Copy editing is about 2 cents per line. Since a good digital cover is one that stands out on a thumbnail size, they're just not that expensive to develop. And even great developmental editing can be bought a la carte on the internet. My book, the single most important influence to me when I was writing it, was a 12-time mystery writer based in North Carolina who I have yet to meet. I got connected to her through a UCLA writing extension program. She was basically my developmental editor for the 18 months that I was writing the book. And she actually had more of an influence on the storyline than even the magnificent editors I ended up with at Random House, because she was there throughout its creation. So even world-class developmental editing can be found online. Physical channel, authors can't get into this physical channel on their own cost-effectively, but if we end up in a largely digital world in which authors do make quite a bit more money per copy on books that they sell directly, by definition, through sheer algebra, the physical channel alone will not flip the financial equation about self-publishing. It can be part of it, but it won't flip it alone. And even the venture financing function could lose its relevance. Services like Kickstarter could be very important here simply because the numbers just aren't that big. And if the rest of the math really does work out nicely for established authors going direct, this part of the equation just isn't going to be that relevant. So it all comes down to here. Since the other three areas have all come to matter somewhere between quite a bit less to hardly at all for publishers, it all comes down to this quadrant of generating book awareness. And this is a vital time to focus on it. Because while we've only seen the earliest rumblings of established authors defecting from publishers, we've seen in other markets how suddenly things can change when the value equations shift violently. And this quadrant is where the publisher's superpowers lie. They don't tend to spend a ton of money on marketing, but they can outspend any self-published author. And these next two things, PR and reviewer access, these are all about the credibility which a respected publisher uniquely can confer on an author. There's hundreds of thousands of undifferentiated self-published authors out there. And when a journalist is deciding who to cover, reviewers deciding which book to actually read, the imprint of a major publisher is very significant. But the most ephemeral and important piece, and the last piece I'll talk about, is this thing called platform. As a newcomer to the industry, I find this to be the most annoying word in publishing. When a publisher asks you about your platform, what they're basically saying is, what are you, the author, going to do to sell your book? Do you have a TV show, a major blog? Are you part of a major scandal? Ideally, even perhaps a crime? I think it's a lazy question because there was a time just a couple decades ago when the author's platform was the author's published works and the publishers and the authors worked together to build that. Then TV, cable TV really, and the internet came along and created a world of thousands, even tens of thousands of micro celebrities who have their own platforms when there used to be dozens, maybe hundreds of major celebrities. It became very easy for the publishers to pick and choose. Author with platform, what's your platform? I don't think they get to do that anymore because I think that that author who comes in with this magical machine that can sell 100,000 books, I'm getting the time out, is going to look to the publisher and say, what are you bringing me? I think the answer needs to be more platform. And if I had a moment for my last point, but I know you guys all have to go, I would talk about the wonderful things that I think publishers and authors can do together to build platform together now. I think it's a very, very interesting subject, and I think it's an electrifying time. I personally think that being in business with a publisher is infinitely more satisfying than being a self-published author, and I think there's a lot of potential there. I am out of time. If anybody has questions, come on up. Anybody wants a review copy, come on up. And if you got to get to your next thing, enjoy. Thank you very much.